You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling.
So this is episode 8.
Wow.
Yeah. Do you have anything to say?
No, not really.
You like to jump right into reading, don't you?
I guess so. Do you have anything to say?
I bought a trailer.
Yes.
Very excited about that. You heard the heartbeat?
Yes, that is the one thing I was thinking I could
of the
say.
Baby. That was the one thing you were thinking of saying?
Yeah.
Well, you should have said it.
Yeah.
It's big news.
It is. Well, and it was funny because I was like, I thought I had heard the heartbeat before, but it...
You mean like while taking a shower?
No. No, so the IVF clinic, like the discharge appointment or a couple appointments there, they detect the heartbeat. But the one in Arizona is not as good as the one in New Jersey. So when we did it in New Jersey, we actually got to hear the heartbeat then. But the one in Arizona, they only actually like perceived it or like saw it visually. Mm. But I never heard it. Mm. So... anyways, I was confused because I thought I'd heard the heartbat before, but then I realized I actually hadn't heard the heartbat before, so that was exciting to hear it.
Are you saying we live in like a second world country?
Well, given our experience with IVF in Arizona, one could argue that.
Well, we're small town people.
Yeah.
Small town people have been denied access to high technology medical care, apparently. Yes. I bet you if we were to go up to Phoenix, we would get the best of the best.
No. Well, you know where the top three clinics are. And
well, okay, that's okay. IVF, fair enough. There's not one of the top three.
Okay, we haven't even shared our story.
Of IVF?
Yes, have we? I don't think so.
Yeah,
okay, the quick version. This is our PSA. Is that what they call it?
PSA?
Sorry, community service announcement, whatever, something like that.
No, it's STD, honey. It's just STD. This is our STD. PDS. No, PDA. This is our PDA.
Yeah. What's that mean?
Public display of affection. This is our PDI, okay. Public display of infertility.
The quick version is we went to a clinic to do an egg extraction here in Arizona. And
don't you have to go like way farther back than
no,
that?
No.
Okay.
Well,
okay. Go
my
ahead.
My partner here is infertile from chemo treatment.
First of all, I don't like being called your partner. Okay. And you just literally shared my medical information.
I thought you talked
on the
about
internet.
It before.
I
think you talked about having cancer.
I don't know. I feel like there was no consent there.
Okay.
I had cancer. That's true. I had cancer and chemo made me infertile. Okay, fair enough. We're talking about my testicles now. Go ahead.
But you had banked sperm.
I banked sperm
and
before.
And it was totally your idea.
Before chemo.
Very
yeah.
impressive.
And let me tell you about banking sperm now. No, I'm kidding.
Because the doctor didn't even really warn you.
Okay, yeah. So go ahead. So
the quick version is.
So we have sperm in the freezer and so therefore go.
So I did an egg extraction in Tucson at a place called ARI. They extracted 20 eggs, and we ended up with 0 viable embryos, which at the time was devastating. We then talked to a woman who I think her website is down, unfortunately. It used to be empoweredivf.com, and she said to us, well, given...
What was her name? Say, share her name.
Rhonda Levy.
Rhonda Levy, exactly.
Name. And she's, I mean, we we should send her more money. You know, she's like
amazing. She's a fertility consultant.
So she's like a coach, like a sort of independent advisor. And she said to us that it's all about the lab. So that's the stat you want to look at. And there are basically that we should go to one of the top three clinics in the country. One is in Portland. One is in Denver.
Yep.
And one is in New Jersey. We were living part-time in New York, so we decided to go to the one in New Jersey, RMA New Jersey. There are RMAs in New York, but they are not actually the same organization, or I don't know, they're like not actually affiliated, so it has to be RMA New Jersey.
Basking Ridge, New Jersey.
Well, that was our specific one, but I think all of RMA New Jersey is part of the same organization affiliation. And so there, with the egg extraction, they got 43 eggs, and we had, prior to our transfers, 15 viable embryos, which is awesome. And the reason this is a PDA is just that the clinic is really important, and that's just something we didn't know. The clinic here actually has since gone out of business, so it's questionable if there was some really bad stuff going on there or what was up, but those stats are really important. So if you're in that situation, I would be happy to talk more to you about it. I have lots of opinions.
I like how you call it, you still call it a PDA.
I know, thanks.
That's awesome. I don't know if we cleared up. It's a PSA. That's what you're looking for.
Parental service announcement.
Yes, exactly. Public service announcement.
That's it.
That's what
Thank
you're
you.
Looking okay. for. PSA.
Thank you.
That's right. 15 viable embryos in the freezer. That means they're 6 days old and they're ready to run. our son is the first one that we got, and that worked out great. And our daughter is in the oven, and she is number 14.
And we are 13 weeks pregnant, and we have no idea what to do with all our embryos.
With our embarrassment of riches.
Yeah.
We don't know what to do. Anyhow, that was a pretty heavy beginning. But that's our fertility story. So we're here to, and it's a good story. It's a beautiful story. I think the only thing I have to say about it is very intense having living, ready to go babies in a freezer waiting for you to bring them to life.
It's mostly intense because we don't think we can do all of them.
I think it's intense because you feel like it would be so amazing to do all of them.
Yeah.
Like you almost feel like you sort of have them, like they're there. You just have to go pick them up at the store, you know?
True.
But it's obviously not that easy. But it's an overwhelming temptation, and you feel an affection for them already because they kind of have started to exist. The way you don't really feel affection for just a baby in abstracto, you know, like oh, we could have another baby, but there's not even anything there. But now they're literally sitting there in a freezer, chatting. Trying to reach us, saying...
Trying to call.
Are you going to let us live or throw us away? It's crazy. Anyhow, let's get back to Heidegger.
Well, that went heavy.
Huh?
That went heavy.
It's true.
I know.
Right? I was trying to just like capture what's different about it than just, as they say, jumping in the sack.
Yeah.
It's that they are sitting there. Staring at you, you know?
Yeah.
It's weird. But I don't think we can have 15 kids. You know, and they say to us, oh, only it's a 50% chance that one will actually, you know, be born. But I don't think that's the case for us because we don't really have fertility problems.
Yeah.
You know? So we're going to do our best. We'll have as many as we can. Sorry, you'll have as many as you can. I think we'll get more into that later.
Yeah.
I think that was enough of that.
Yeah.
Heidegger, contributions to philosophy of the event. We're plowing our way through section 5, What?
Yeah.
Right?
Five has been a big one.
It has been a big one. Five is a big one. I can't think of a longer section, although I haven't read the whole book, but it's pretty long for a section. He seems to have kind of carried away with himself, I would say. But yeah, you know where we are. Section five. If a Thoughtful Question. This song is called If a Thoughtful Question. So why don't you go ahead and read?
If a thought, excuse me. If a thoughtful question is not so simple and so salient that it determines the will and style of thinking for hundreds of years by assigning them the highest matter to be thought, then it is best that that question remain unasked. For if it is merely parroted, the question only adds wares to the nonstop bazaar, offering a bewildering array of changing, quote, problems and, quote, reproaches that concern nothing and no one.
I love that. Yeah, that's amazing, nice. Right? So he's pushing us to ask thoughtful questions that are so simple and so salient that they determine the will and style of thinking for hundreds of years. Otherwise, why parrot these questions that are just problems and reproaches, and adding wares to the nonstop bazaar of offering a bewildering array of changing problems and reproaches that concern nothing and no one.
I just did some unfollowing on a account that used to follow a lot of spiritual accounts, Instagram account, and it's just like looking at those, like the quotes that go on Instagram that are like, I don't even know. But like, just.
Is it a bewildering array of
yes,
changing problems and reproaches that concern nothing and no one?
It is. It was pretty wild.
Yeah.
So that's, yeah.
But I think that one of the things that ties in with this paragraph is Heidegger's always challenging us to be quiet, in a sense, and to be reticent and to be deferent, ask thoughtful questions that get to the heart of matters, and not just questions about any old thing, I guess, or questions. I'm not sure, how he would delineate a thoughtful question versus an unthoughtful question. I mean, he's being a little sort of vague and I'd almost say like insult comic.
I mean, are his questions really that simple and salient? I mean, they're salient. I'm not sure they're simple. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would imagine that the German there for simple is going to mean sort of direct and basic and pointed.
Yeah. What does it clear. Mean to be?
Yeah, what does it mean to be? Yeah, exactly.
That's a pretty good
Well, and he's talked before about sort of how we ignore the simple and the basic and those are often the main things, the things that that get us to the crux of things. So I don't think simple for him is a pejorative term.
Yeah.
Anyhow, that's a nice paragraph, but go ahead.
If measured along such lines, then how fares the question of being as the question of the truth of being? A question which in itself, by turning, asks at the same time about the being of truth. How long must be the way on which the question of truth is merely first encountered? Should I keep going?
How long must be the way on which the question of truth is merely first encountered? How long do we have to go before we even encounter the question of truth? Yeah. I don't know. It's a good question.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Whatever in the future can truly be called philosophy must primarily and exclusively accomplish this: to first find, i.e. to ground, the place of the thoughtful asking of the newly inceptual question, or, in other words, to ground Dasein.
Yeah, the future of philosophy must primarily concern itself with grounding Dasein, asking thoughtful questions within this newly inceptual world or newly inceptual methodology to ground Dasein. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
The thoughtful question of the truth of being is the moment bearing the transition. This moment is never actually identifiable, and still less even it be calculated in advance. Did I miss something?
Yeah.
This moment is never actually identifiable.
I would go back to the thoughtful question of the truth of being. Read that sentence. This moment is never
actually identifiable. And still less can it be calculated.
Yeah, yeah, I think you skipped a line. Yeah, why don't you start at the beginning of the paragraph again, maybe?
The thoughtful question of the truth of being is the moment bearing the transition. This moment is never actually identifiable, and still less can it be calculated in advance. It itself first marks the time of the event. The unique simplicity of this transition will never be graspable historiologically, because public historiological, quote, history has long since passed the transition by, provided the transition can be shown indirectly to such, quote, history at all. Thus, a long future is reserved for this moment, supposing that the abandonment of beings by being is to be broken off once more.
Yeah, that's important stuff. The thoughtful question of the truth of being is the moment that accomplishes this transition to a new kind of philosophy whose goal is to ground Dasein. So the thoughtful question of the truth of being is the start of that transition. And this start or this moment is not actually ever identifiable. Can't ever really spot it. And still less can it be calculated in advance. So you literally can't identify it. And you cannot program or foresee or
try to make
plan for it. What?
Try to make it happen.
Yeah. It itself first marks the time of the event. So it itself is the time of the event of it. It doesn't have a preceding archaeology that builds up to it. The unique simplicity of this transition, meaning asking the thoughtful question of the truth of being, will never be graspable historiologically. So historiology, or the history that tells stories, will never be able to grasp this unique simplicity of asking thoughtful questioning of the truth of being, because public historiological history has long since passed that transition by. It's long since kind of moved beyond it and decided to ignore it as something that it can't identify. And identify is an important word here. They can't give it an identity. It can't process it or register it in its identitarian roadmap and obsessive lunging forward through time. It can't identify it, even if the transition can be shown indirectly to such history at all. This transition can't even be seen by history. Thus, a long future is reserved for this moment. This moment is going to be going on for a long time, supposing that the abandonment of beings by being is to be broken off once more. So supposing that beings being abandoned by being will possibly come to an end again, that being and beings will be reunited. So beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I love that paragraph because it bespeaks to me this odd feeling of when dedicated to the thoughtful asking of the truth of Bang in order to ground Dasein and entering into that transition and have and experiencing that moment. I feel that I've experienced that moment. I feel you've experienced that moment, that transition, this transition that we're living in a way. And what's often so frustrating about it, when I talk to other people about it, or I talk to other people even not about it, but I talk to them about what they want to talk about, it feels that my transition that I made can't even be identified by them. They can't even see it. They can't even register it. And they have, in a sense, as he says here, long since passed it by. And they don't even view it as part of the historiological advance of thought and civilization and philosophy. They see it as a kind of a odd, incalculable, unidentifiable blip or silence. And yet, I feel it has a long future, and I feel that it is part of bringing being back to beings, which I think he says, supposing that the abandonment of beings by being is to be broken off once more. And that makes me feel like there was a time when it was broken off, that abandonment was not occurring. And I feel like that's before the first beginning. So I think he's kind of pointing us to a prior state of consciousness before the first beginning that this transition is bringing us once more to, which is beings are being returned to being, being is being returned to beings. Yeah.
That's nice.
Go ahead.
In Dasein and as Dasein, Bang appropriates truth, and truth itself reveals Bang as refusal, as that domain of intimations and of withdrawal, the domain of stillness, in which the advent and absconding of the last God are first decided. Toward that end, the human being can accomplish nothing, least of all, if to this being is assigned the preparation for the grounding of Dasein, indeed assigned in such a way that this task again radically determines the essence of the human being.
Wow.
Wait, why can the human being accomplish nothing? I'm not quite following.
So, in Dasein and as Dasein, which is us, or through the Dasein of us, Bang appropriates truth, and truth itself reveals Bang as refusal, as that domain of intimations and of withdrawal, the domain of stillness, in which the advent and absconding of the last God are first decided. So in Dasein, Bang appropriates truth. Bang takes truth into itself. And truth itself then reveals Bang as several things here. Refusal, a domain of intimations, a domain of withdrawal, a domain of stillness. So Bang is revealed by truth to be refusal and a domain of intimation and withdrawal and stillness, in which the coming and going of the last God are first decided. In that domain, the coming and going of the last God are first decided. First decided, it's an interesting word there, not first visualized or first noticed, but first decided. And toward that end, toward the end of this whole thing, toward the goal of Bang appropriating truth and truth revealing Bang as refusal and entering this domain, the human being can accomplish nothing. So he's saying essentially that this happens beyond the human being, outside the human being. The human being is not the decisive factor in all of this. It's truth and Bang and the domain of intimations and withdrawals and silence in which the last God comes and goes. So you can accomplish nothing toward that end, toward the end of truth appropriating Bang and Bang appropriating truth. Doesn't mean there's nothing to do, but it means that that happens outside the human being. And again, human being here is important phrase because that's different than Dasein. Remember, Dasein is not human being. Dasein is a facet or a manifestation or a commitment or a projection of human being. It's a way of human being. So, for instance, this sentence could read, toward that end, Dasein can accomplish everything, right? Mm-hmm. But the human being can accomplish nothing. Mm-hmm. Least of all, if to this being is to this human being is assigned the preparation for the grounding of Dasein. See, so this this human being can't prepare for the grounding of Dasein. Indeed, assigned in such a way that this task again radically determines the essence. It's Dasein that does this. Not the human being. So he's drawing this distinction between human being and Dasein. One, I'm not sure we can clarify right now, but there's a distinction there. Mm-hmm. And I think, I would almost say that human being is the state of humanness that is dedicated to beings, and Dasein is the state of humanness that is dedicated to Bang. Mm.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I might have a little more to say on that later. What do you think? Should we keep going? Six?
Yeah, I think it's just really cool how he takes these like a phrase like human being, and there are just so many different facets to it, which is really amazing when you think of it like truth or something. I just like these words that just have so many different meanings or possible different kinds, different energies or the nodes. They're different nodes.
Yeah. I mean, how often have you read the word truth and the word human being?
Yeah.
And the word God,
yeah,
right, and the word essence, and just brushed by them. Mm-hmm. But when you read them in this context, it's like they're just glowing, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah,
and they're just like stuff's just shooting off them. Like they're just their meaning content feels so heavy and full. Mm-hmm. And shining and full of emanation and effulgence. It's just like so much meaning.
Yeah,
it's almost like I would almost compare it to like Walmart produce versus like something you grow yourself. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like that taste.
Yeah,
that taste of like real food.
Yeah,
it's like the word truth, right? Like you can mm-hmm. it can be like nothing or it can be everything. Mm-hmm. If put in the right way. And I don't mean to diss Walmart produce. I don't know. I guess, well, maybe I do actually. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like sort of like bland food.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. It's pretty cool.
Should we keep going or?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking I might. I mean, it's the end of chapter five or yeah. section five, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's keep going a little bit.
Okay. Six, the basic disposition. In the first beginning, wonder. In the other beginning, foreboding. Everything would be misinterpreted and would miscarry if we wanted to prepare the basic disposition with the help of an analysis or even a, quote, definition, and bring it into the free domain of its dispositional power.
Okay, hold on. So I think that foreboding word is important.
Yes.
Because I'd imagine it doesn't make you very happy.
I don't know. It doesn't make me happy. Well, it's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I guess.
What does it mean?
Yeah, I mean, I say that just because I think, you know, it's like here we are dedicating ourselves to like the other beginning, and he's saying that at its heart it is foreboding, which you know has this sense of anxiety, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Doesn't it? Yeah, anxiety. So I wanted to quickly look at the German words that he's using here. They're interesting because they're actually more linked in the German. Wonder is erstaunen, and foreboding is erahnen. So they have this kind of ER, and he hyphenates them, so it's ER dash staunen and ER dash ahnen. And so erstaunen means to, in a sense, astonish. It means astonishment, wonder. To be astonished and awed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And erahnen is it's not in my French dictionary. Wow, so it's a not a very common word. I'll look it up on the. I happen to have the internet here.
Wait, what is this French dictionary thing? It goes from German to French?
Yes.
From German to English? Okay, just checking.
It goes from German to French. It's a French.
And then you translate the French to English.
Yeah, because I kind of know the French good enough, so. Yeah, so erahnen actually, okay, so this is interesting. Erahnen, Google translates it as to guess. Huh. And the Cambridge Dictionary of German to English translates it as to surmise or to sense. So there's no indication whatsoever of foreboding here in this. Well, and here's an even nicer array of words. To guess, to imagine, to sense, to glimpse, to anticipate, to surmise, to know, and to foresee. So why did the translators choose to forebode?
Wait, there was one. Yeah, sorry, can you read that last list again? Guess, imagine, foresee. What else was there?
Sorry, say that again?
Can you read that last list again that said to guess, to imagine?
Yes. To guess, to imagine, to sense, to glimpse, to anticipate, to suspect, to surmise, to know, and to foresee.
Yeah, I mean, I guess anticipate and suspect.
Yeah, they're a little bit there, except that, you know, forebode, so there's no indication in the German that this word indicates pre-sensing something bad.
Yeah.
It's just anticipating, surmising, foreseeing. Mm-hmm. Those are neutral.
Yeah.
But foreboding, I mean, good Lord, the definition of forebode, you know, is pretty clear. To have a presentiment of something bad.
Right. And he does use the word presentiment, or they do, the translator use that later.
Yeah. But I would really quibble with this this foreboding. I mean, foreboding is like dun 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 dun. You know, like a horror movie. I mean, foreboding means literally fearful. Here's the definition: fearful apprehension.
Yeah. Right.
Implying or seeming to imply that something bad is going to happen.
So, do you just feel it's a mistranslation?
Basically? It's an absolute mistranslation.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, for instance, if I were to go to English to German and I were put in forebode, it gives me vorahnung, vorahnen, a different word. It's a different word. Mm-hmm. It's a totally different word.
Yeah.
It's an absolute mistranslation. Yeah. like vorahnen, vorahnen in German, vorahnen, right, means to foreshadow or to forebode. So they mistranslated that word.
Yeah.
Forahnen could be forebode. Mm-hmm. Erahnen is just again to surmise, to guess, to anticipate.
Maybe anticipate isn't even really right.
I mean, I think you're right. In English, anticipate is like, I'm anticipating.
Yeah.
It's almost like you're excited
maybe
for something.
Reading
that's
it.
A little less neutral. You're right.
Yeah.
But I'm belaboring this point because I didn't want you to.
Thank you. To quit.
To quit. Exactly. Please don't give up on Heidegger yet. He's not saying that anxiety is the central disposition of the other beginning.
Yeah.
He's saying actually something far more interesting with this distinction between Erstaunen and Erahnen. He's saying that wonder or amazement is the first beginning. Wow. Ooh.
Yeah.
Awe. You know, wow. Oh, gosh. Mm-hmm. Philosophy as like gasp and being taken aback.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the disposition of the first beginning of philosophy. And the disposition of the other beginning is to guess.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Another one is to imagine, to glimpse. I almost feel like Erahnen carries this vibe of like to kind of see.
Yeah, right? That's right, yeah.
To have an inkling.
Yeah.
That would almost be where I would put it, at inkling, to inkle. So the basic disposition of the other beginning is to inkle. So that's okay, good. Are you still with us?
Yeah.
You're still in the cult?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah, okay, because there's only two members, and if there was just one member, it would not be a cult. Right. Well, there would be me and Heidegger, so there would be two. Okay, so let's proceed. I'm glad I had my dictionary.
Go ahead. Excellent, yeah. Is it weird, though, that I was like going to just be like, you know, it's okay? now that I think about it, I'm like...
Yeah, kind of.
That is kind of weird.
Why was it okay with you? What was your original thinking? You were like, yeah, it's obviously foreboding. Like, I feel that all the time. Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I mean, I guess I was giving the benefit of not knowing how he was, I guess, meaning that word, in that you're right. Either the actual word itself not quite meaning what I think it means, or that you know, maybe it starts with that and it goes to something else. Or
sure.
Something.
Well, that's fair.
But
that's definitely the terrain you're in.
Yeah. But it is, I don't know, maybe it's a little weird that I was forgiving of that. I'm not sure. But it does seem like he does usually go on to explain things, and it usually makes sense.
That's right. Let's put it this way. I think you trust Martin.
Yes, that's right.
You've grown to trust him.
I have.
And trust is a fragile thing, but I don't think he's ever quite broken it with you.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
So that's a good point. So that explains it.
So keep to the straight and narrow, Martin, because she can feel betrayed. Go ahead.
Okay, so the next paragraph.
The next paragraph.
Everything would be misinterpreted and would miscarry if we wanted to prepare the basic disposition with the help of an analysis or even a, quote, definition, and bring it into the free domain of its dispositional power. Yet now and then we must speak, quote, about disposition in order to point the way. But only because psychology has for a long time restricted the scope of the word, quote, disposition, i.e. only because the craving for, quote, lived experiences, end quote, today, without a meditation on disposition, would all the more drag astray everything said of it.
What?
Yeah.
Sure. Everything in this other beginning would basically fall to pieces.
Mm-hmm.
If we wanted to prepare the basic disposition with the help, if we wanted to prepare the basic disposition of, guessing, having an inkling, with the help of an analysis or even a definition and bring it into the free domain of its dispositional power, if we wanted to basically understand this disposition through an analysis or a definition. So he's saying don't get too heavy on what it means.
Mm.
Yet, now and then we must speak about disposition, right? So he's saying, like, don't take this disposition thing too intense, like that's the only thing that the other beginning is about, or constantly return to that disposition or feel caged or stuck in that disposition. Because sometimes we just must speak about disposition in order to point the way. Only because psychology has for a long time restricted the scope of the word disposition. So psychology has taken this idea of disposition and said something like, well, that person is disposed to this. So psychology has, he says, for a long time, kind of neutered and delimited and shrunk down the scope of what he means by the word disposition. And so we must speak about disposition because the craving for lived experiences today, without a meditation on disposition, would all the more drag astray everything said of it. So I think he's saying, you know, this word disposition has lost its way, has lost its meaning. It's been ruined, and I think we need to return to it and talk about what it means and how we engage with it. And let me just say that the German for disposition here,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah,
is Grundstimmung, and that's a really interesting word. Because if we look at the translations of these, Stimmung, I believe, is about is the word for mood.
Hmm.
Stimmung means mood, Stimmen, which is very linked to it, is voice, and vote. And tune. So Grundstimmung means basic mood, basic voice, basic sound, basic choice. Right?
That's nice, yeah.
Grundstimmung. And he's saying that psychology has restricted the scope of this word. And it says a craving for lived experiences without a meditation on disposition would drag astray everything said of disposition. So this craving for lived experiences today, I'm not sure what he means by all that. Do you have anything you could...
I don't, but I think we should keep going because he's about to do some more interesting things, I think.
Represent. Go ahead.
All essential thinking demands that its thoughts and utterances be newly extracted each time, like an ore, out of the basic disposition. if the basic disposition is lacking, then everything is a forced clatter of concepts and of mere shells of words. Wait, so when he says basic disposition, that means like basic, like you were saying, basic mood, voice, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So basic is not in the word disposition. That's the words together. I see.
Basic is not in the word. Well, disposition in German means Grundstimmung. Or sorry, Grundstimmung in German is the word he's using here for disposition. Grundstimmung. And in German, the two words brought together to make the word Grundstimmung or disposition are Grund and Stimmung. Mm-hmm. And Grund, you know, is in a sense ground.
Mm-hmm.
Base, also reason, cause. It's a very laden word. Mm-hmm. So
is he in German? Is he saying basic and then?
No.
No. Okay. Thank you.
Well, is he saying basic disposition? Ah. Is there a difference between disposition and No, I think
translating Grundstimmung as basic disposition.
Well, that's a good question. Let me see.
Or as just disposition.
Out of the basic. Alles wesentliche
Denken. You just look at the title.
Seine Gedanken.
You just look at the title 6, the basic disposition.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah, what is it in German?
Yeah, no, that's Grundstimmung.
Okay, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So disposition actually just means mood and voice. And basic is ground, base.
Yeah, so Grundstimmung is means basic disposition. But
right.
If you know, Grundstimmung is so like if you enter Grundstimmung into the dictionary, it says it means basic mood.
Mm.
Which I guess in English they're translating as disposition. Stimmung, I guess Stimmung would technically be the word for disposition or mood.
Right.
That's right. And Grund is the word is the adjective basic. Yeah, that's right. But I mean, I think basic disposition is really, you know, of the other beginning. The disposition, the basic disposition, the central disposition of the other beginning is Erahnen, or what we're calling. Which one are we going to choose for the basic?
Inkling.
Wait,
what was it? Inking.
Inkling. Yeah, having an inkling, guessing, surmising, anticipating, imagining. Yeah.
Yeah.
All essential thinking demands that its thoughts and utterances be newly extracted each time, like an ore out of the basic disposition. I mean, so if the basic disposition is lacking, then everything is a forced clatter of concepts and the mere shells of words. I mean, that's a strong statement, right?
Yeah.
He's saying that in the other beginning, this disposition of Erahnen, or guessing, surmising, imagining, foreseeing, anticipating, inkling, is so key that all essential thinking must emerge from it. All its thoughts and utterances must be newly extracted each time from it. Mm-hmm. So he's saying that this disposition must be our total guide.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's lacking, everything we say is nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, let me keep going. Since indeed a misconception about, quote, thinking has long since dominated the common opinion regarding, quote, philosophy, the way disposition is represented and judged can therefore be absolutely nothing other than a scion of this misinterpretation of thinking. Disposition is weak, erratic, unclear, and dull versus the acuity, certainty, clarity, and nimbleness of, quote, thought. In the best case, disposition might be tolerated as an embellishment of thinking. So is he saying...
On the other hand, the basic disposition disposes Dasein and thereby disposes thinking as a projection of the truth of Bang in word and concept. Yeah, so a misconception about thinking has long since dominated the common opinion regarding philosophy. The way disposition is represented and judged can therefore be absolutely nothing other than a scion of this misinterpretation of thinking, or a descendant of this. So I think I think it's important. So I think we could probably plug into this a little better as English speakers if we understood that the word disposition, we could actually just say mood.
Mm.
Okay? So what he's saying is that, look at this part where he says, disposition is weak, erratic, yeah, unclear, and dull, versus the acuity, certainty, clarity, and nimbleness of thought.
Mm-hmm.
What he's saying is that psychology has taken this word mood and made it just kind of a ancillary, an afterthought, a thing of that's fleeting and erratic and weak. And it's just, oh, I'm having a mood. You know, I'm in a mood. You know, I'm a little angry today. I'm feeling giddy. I'm whatever. Mood. It's a temporary, shallow appendage of our psychological core, apparently. And thinking is apparently, or thought is apparently, you know, objective and removed and not under the sway of mood. Mood doesn't control thought. Thought is sacrosanct and safe from mood. Mm-hmm. This is what psychology has set up. And he's saying, actually, mood disposes Dasein and disposes thinking as a projection of the truth of Bang. He's actually just saying mood or disposition is actually where we live and where thinking occurs. And to think that there's thinking outside of mood or disposition is to participate in a kind of fallacy.
Mm-hmm.
So he's making a really kind of sweet claim that our moods are not just things to be brushed away, that they're actually where we live and think and how we experience the world.
Yeah. And also that thought is not necessarily acuity, certainty, clarity, and nimbleness.
That's right.
That we've created this difference between them, but actually who's to say that thought is any of those things, especially if it's not coming out of the basic disposition.
That's right.
Of inking.
Yep, and look at this next sentence. Disposition, or mood, is the diffusion of the trembling of Bang as event in Dasein. I mean, mood is the spreading out or the expression of the trembling of Bang as event in Dasein. So we really should be looking to disposition, because that's where Bang trembles and diffuses as an event in Dasein. I mean, he's just like saying,
yeah,
in a sense he's saying, like, go with your feelings. In a sense, you know, I mean,
well, I'm curious actually to hear now more about the word disposition.
Okay, go. Do you want to read on? Because he keeps talking about it, or what?
Does he? Well, I'm actually curious
I mean, more. He kind of does, but...
Can you go back to the German? So disposition, you had originally said mood, voice. Is there more about it?
More about the word disposition?
Yeah.
Well... okay, let's look at the definition of disposition.
Or maybe it's not important, because what's more important is the inkling, actually.
Yeah, I mean...
that's the word that's more important.
Well, look, so we have mood, right? We have mood in English, which is always sort of a very temporary thing that you're always trying to get over.
Yeah.
Trying to get out. I'm in a mood, I'm trying to get out of it. Yeah. Or somebody is somebody, you experience somebody and they're having a mood, well, you just, you don't take everything they say or think at face value because it's mood tainted. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the definition of disposition, it's a little more powerful. It says a person's inherent qualities of mind and character, or the way in which something is placed or arranged, especially in relation to other things. Okay, here's Wikipedia on disposition. A disposition is a quality of character, a habit, a preparation, a state of readiness, or a tendency to act in a specific way.
Yeah.
So disposition is a much more powerful.
Yeah, it's a little less fleeting than, yeah, the mood.
Than mood.
Or feelings.
Yeah. But it's an important thing he's saying. He's I think he's really telling us where to look and how to think about this positionality of Dasein vis-a-vis the grounding of the truth of Bang and where we go to find our presence and our sense of appropriate placement in that turning and in that project. And he's saying that instead of starting at thought, even though we've been told that thought is certain, clear, and nimble and acute, and has acuity, and we've been preferenced toward thought. He's saying we should start at the basic disposition of this other beginning, which is guessing, surmising, foreseeing, imagining, inkling. Like stay there, start there, stay there. And don't, and most importantly, don't go to wonder or awe or amazement. Now that's that's kind of interesting.
Yeah,
I think I wonder if I could tell a story.
Yeah,
a little bit. I mean, I'm not going to call it a story, but I wonder if I could illuminate this a little bit by talking about that friend of mine who you know.
Okay.
And his sleep problems.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think it ties in.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah, yeah.
So I'll try to make this quick as possible. But I have this friend who messaged me and a couple other friends in a group chat saying he was suffering from insomnia and he couldn't sleep. And we gave him some basic recommendations like exercising and not drinking And he kind of said, oh, I tried all those things. And the same day, or the next morning, he sent out an email, a mass email, marketing email, about his new film. And in the promo blurb for the film, he said that the film was important and relevant because, and this is a quote, authoritarianism is gaining a foothold across the Western world. And this is a friend who I think I would say I have had a really hard time getting to take my interest in Heidegger seriously. Or getting him to engage in some of the vocabulary and other beginning dispositional thinking, when I read him say that authoritarianism is gaining a foothold across the Western world, and the same day that he said he was unable to sleep, it kind of got me thinking about Bang and beings, because he's a person who I would say is incredibly fixated on beings rather than on being or Bang, and on story or historiology rather than history, or story as a thing. And so I made this list of what I really wanted to say to him about sleeping. And it's a kind of Heideggerian list, I would say. To me, it's a lot about I would say his general disposition is wonder. his basic disposition is wonder and amazement. He's a very amazed and wonder-filled guy, and that's kind of what's wonderful about him. And I think I've tried to push him toward a different disposition of surmisal and guessing and inkling. So I guess I wanted to read this little list.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
And I think my advice, I haven't sent all this to him, sent this to him because I think I've probably gone on too long with him too much and he's kind of over it. But this is to me sort of, I would say the Heideggerian solution to insomnia. And I made this list and it's, you want to push things that are heavy all day long. And so instead of light things, you want to push heavy things. You want to have all your nerves engaged in struggles. You want to wrestle with bang, not with beings, because most being wrestling is just throwing ideas around, while bang is a more sort of concrete, heavy, mysterious wrangling of indiscernibles. You want to, I think that you kind of want to get involved in real struggles. I would almost say the kind of struggles that the basic disposition of the other beginning involve you in, as opposed to not struggling, which would be sort of the disposition of wonder and amazement, or struggling with identitarian struggles, which are just simply thought struggles and are kind of like armchair struggles. Yes, exactly. Thank you. You want to get dedicated to labor, not to leisure. You want to shed all your guilt, and you want to shed all your hate, and you want to shed all your anxiety. You want to, I wrote this down, you want to cherish democracy, not order. You want to value individual decisions, not top-down construction. You want to climb the hill outside your house, really, like genuinely climb it, not imagine the mountaintops you could climb on if you were to achieve perfect justice in the world. You want to fix things yourself. You want to outsource as little as possible the thinking that you need to do to fix things. You need to have problems to solve, not stuff to worry about. I wrote down you need to turn off the enlightenment. You need to play instead of watch the game. You need to stop being carried around and walk. You need to stop watching movies, because movies are just going to take you somewhere where you can't do anything and get you wound up about things that you can't unwind about. You want to fear nothing. You want to have individual and not collective ambitions. You want to embrace nature and biologism. And in a sense, you want to always be asleep. I think there might be something in this book later on about, I don't know, for me, it's kind of this this idea of, he says here, all essential thinking demands that its thoughts and utterances be newly extracted each time, like an ore out of the basic disposition. There's something there to me about sleep state, dream state, the way thoughts occur in sleep. And then, you know, this guy I'm talking about is a filmmaker, and he's a big story. He has a cinema club, and he's big into story and films. And I wanted to read something that Lastly, I think this idea, I think my main advice to him is to try to extract himself from stories, which he's, you know, very addicted to. And I think that somehow wonder and awe are at the root of that. Like he moves day in and day out from one sort of story awe to another. Like he pursues them because stories amaze him and provide him with wonder. And he would probably say wonder is the prime virtue of living. And I've felt a great frustration in kind of trying to push him beyond that. And I realize now reading this, I'm trying to push him to this other beginning and this Er-Anon. But I wanted to read something that I read Derrida say about stories. So Derrida, I'm reading a book by Derrida on Heidegger. Can I keep going?
Yeah.
I'm reading a book by Heidegger on, about Heidegger by Derrida, and it says, Derrida says, it turns out that each time in philosophy someone wanted to establish an ontology or to renew ontology, which is the study of being, they began by bidding farewell to stories. And then Derrida goes on to say, now what is it to tell stories? To tell stories is to assimilate being and beings. That is, to determine the origin of beings, qua beings, on the basis of another being, or more beings. It is to reply to the question, what is the being of beings, by appealing to another being, supposed to be its cause or origin. It is to close the opening and to suppress the question of the meaning of being. Which does not mean that every ontic or being-based explication in itself comes down to telling stories. When the sciences determine causalities, legalities that order the relations between beings, when theology explains the totality of beings on the basis of creation or the ordering brought about by a supreme being, they are not necessarily telling stories. They tell stories when they want to pass their discourse off as the reply to the question of the meaning of being, or when, incidentally, they refuse this question all seriousness. When the sciences or theology or metaphysics say, quote, we're dealing with beings, with the beings in this region, or beings in their totality, or beingness, without needing to pose the question of the truth of being, end quote, then these discourses are content to tell stories. And those who speak them refuse to pose the question of knowing what they're talking about and to make explicit the meaning of their language. Whether this gesture be that of metaphysics, of theology, or of science, it is at root the very expression of obscurantism itself. Of an obscurantism in which science is complicit with theology and metaphysics, that humanism, which, as we shall see later, is always associated with this refusal of the question of being, that humanism. So this obscurantism is a humanism that is implicit, that is associated with this refusal of the question of being.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So is he basically saying that stories are relating beings to being and then bringing in another being or beings or bringing in another being as another relative in the story or character in the story, and that through doing that, they create, I think he said, like a discourse, or it can pass off a discourse. But is that the idea that they don't actually address being? Because
yes.
It's just that's saying
that's exactly right. Okay. Yes. Yeah. That's exactly right. So it's that story, what he's calling story is essentially this thing that science, metaphysics, theology, people, the humanities, humanists, stories. Story means when you have beings, there are beings, things that are, all these beings, the clock, the hero, the mom, the car, the house, you know, the war, all these things. Beings are things. And to understand them, you just call up other beings. Mm. And so then you weave stories in which those beings are influencing each other, affecting each other, resulting in one another, fighting each other, destroying each other, creating each other. It's just this big menagerie of beings, right? That's what story is. And story seems to provide spirit and reason and and life and operationability and to these beings. But it's just story. It's just beings affecting other beings. Mm-hmm. And what doesn't get discussed in that menagerie of beings, in that story in which beings are just these components, is what is being? Because they're beings, but nobody's talked about what does that mean that they are, mm-hmm. that they're beings? What is their being? And so the question of being, which is what Heidegger has been trying to push us to, never gets addressed, because story poses as the beingness of beings. Mm-hmm. But it's not the beingness of beings. It's just more beings. Mm-hmm. That's why he says to tell stories is to assimilate being and beings. That is, to determine the origin of beings as beings on the basis of other beings.
Yeah, right.
So in a way, it's to say, what's a being? And you say, well, you point to another being, but they're just beings. They're all beings. And so you never get to the question of being. Now, obviously, this is a little obscure. Like, it's a little like, well, so what? How do we talk about being and not just beings? But that's what Heidegger is trying to push us to. And how to do it is something I think we're not very practiced at. We're not really quite sure what it means. But he says here, to establish an ontology or a science of being, we must begin by bidding farewell to stories. Mm. And I bring up this friend because he was for me a great story guru, and he and I worked on a lot of stories together and studied the philosophy of story and the structure of story, and he is still really wound up in stories.
You're not?
I think that's a really good question. I don't know. I think I am. But I think that there's something where I think to say, are you wound up in story is to say, do you have a mind today, right? Like now, in the arc of history right now.
Yeah, sorry. By that, I meant more in your playwriting, actually.
But I guess
there are different ways.
So what I would say is, I think one of the reasons this book resonates with me is Heidegger seems to be saying that if we're going to get out of story, we need to start. We need to start the other beginning, to try to get out of story, which is another way of just saying we need to start the other beginning to try to understand being. Mm-hmm. But it has a long future, and it's going to be a long road, and it's not even calculable, and it's not even something you can identify. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I would say that I'm just as obsessed by stories as any human being on the planet today, but I smell and I have an inkling of something outside of story, and I would call that bang. And it might be a story that I'm seeking bang, but it feels like a very long term thing, because in a way it's like trying to see outside your own mind and get outside.
Or see outside the first beginning.
Exactly. And Heidegger talks about that. He's like, look, it's not just about throwing 3,000 years of vocabulary away. Like, it's what we are. It's how we think. It's the very way we see and define the world. But I feel like Heidegger's offering us a way to start. He's offering us an other beginning,
yeah.
A new disposition to say, how can we maybe move to this new way of thinking, which is thinking about being as opposed to beings, or bang and instead of beings, and by doing that, can we be freer and discover a new and more truthful form of philosophy and see the last God, mm-hmm. and shed guilt and shed hate and shed anxiety and shed identity. Mm-hmm. I'm adding those things.
Yeah.
And just experience a new thing. And in a sense, like that, and the reason I bring this up, and experience like a new level of exhaustion.
Mm-hmm.
And finally sleep. I don't know. Like, yeah. There's something in there about that.
Yeah.
What do you mean, obviously guilt and anxiety are not good for sleep.
Yeah.
Worrying is not good for sleep. But yeah. I think I'm talking more, I'm not just trying to help cure insomnia. I'm mm-hmm. more kind of like, you know, there's that kind of day you have where you really worked.
Mm-hmm.
Like you actually did real labor. The metaphor I often use is just like you climbed a mountain. Mm-hmm. You know, you climbed a 13-mile mountain and you made it back down before dark, and then you go to sleep.
Well, yeah, that's like the best.
Okay, but
it's
but,
hard to do that every day.
No, you can't do that every day, but I think there's a way of Dasein is that.
Yeah.
Dasein is cognitively climbing that mountain every day. And so when I say things like pushing things that are heavy and having all your nerves engaged in struggles, I just mean get appropriated by bang.
Mm-hmm.
When I say be dedicated to labor, not leisure, have a nation, not a notion, you know, mm-hmm. cherish democracy, not order.
Mm-hmm.
Outsource as little as possible, you know, like mm-hmm. have problems to solve, not stuff to worry about. All that to me is mm-hmm. is just getting appropriated by bang, like mm-hmm. actually engaging with the world
mm-hmm.
or getting engaged with it. I think that there's a lot now, you know, because we can see the whole world on our phone and we have so many struggles and injustices and ambitions and institutions that we're like linked up with, and, you know, intentionally, our intentionality is wrapped up in them, that we're wound up in tons of pseudo struggles, armchair struggles, as you say.
Mm.
And we get really worked up about them, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. So to me, bang is just calling us to, it's a, like, I know this guy and I know that he doesn't finish his day exhausted. He finishes his day more stressed out, more worked up, more anxious, more jacked up by the news and by stories and by aspirations that he can't do anything about, you know, like wishing that this country or this organization or these people were different, mm-hmm. you know? He gets so fucking worked out. How's he supposed to sleep?
Yeah.
And to go back to the beginning, how is he supposed to sleep if he believes yeah. and says to thousands of people in a mass email list, and as this is a guy who won Sundance Film Festival, okay, when he writes a blurb for a film, he's talking to a lot of people, and when he can believe and say to a large mass of people that authoritarianism is gaining a foothold across the Western world, how is he supposed to sleep? Or as I told him, why should he even be allowed to sleep,
yeah.
right? Like I said, get your gun and go, you know, fight for freedom, dude. If authority, but I don't think he really understands what he's saying. I don't think he knows what he means. And he obviously, I think my essential argument, you know, the reason I saw that sentence and thought, oh God, what a bunch of peanut butter, was like, he has zero. This is a guy who really prides himself on being a scientist. He has zero data, zero verifiable, respectable, peer-reviewed studies have been done that can allow us to say, as if we're speaking truth, that authoritarianism is gaining a foothold across the Western world. Mm-hmm. We might have news feeds that seem to indicate that. We might be able to define authoritarianism in such a way that we can say these five events took place and therefore this and that. But gaining a foothold across the Western world is such a – and but that's the kind of statements we make today. Mm-hmm. So general, so vast, so unprovable, so moodish, and so paranoid, and so riddled with anxiety, and so fantastical, and so stupid. And so story-based. It's like a story. It's the story. It's a, such a story. Authoritarianism is gaining a foothold across the Western world. You can see it marching, and you know, and I'm not saying it's not, and I'm not saying it is. I'm saying we can't. There's not even any relation there. There's nothing we can relate to there as actual thinkers. There's things we can relate to there as people of anxiety. There's things we can relate to there as paranoid maniacs. There's things we can relate to as news addicts. But not as scientists and not as thinkers, and certainly not as people who are trying to discover Bang. Because as Heidegger says, all essential thinking demands that its thoughts and utterances be newly extracted each time. To say authoritarianism is gaining, I know that it's like this mantra. It's like this blur. It's like this is what it sounds like in his life. And it's 24 hours a day. That's what it sounds like. Mm-hmm. And it has nothing to do with thoughts and utterances being extracted newly each time from the basic disposition of guessing, inkling, and surmising. It has all to do with crushing the basic disposition of inkling, surmising, and guessing and imagining, and making sure all thoughts and utterances are not newly extracted each time, but they're extracted each time the same as they were the last time. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
I don't know. I've talked enough. Fill me in.
No, I think that's all really well said. Totally. I mean, and that's something we're seeing a lot. I feel like that's also, you know, that's the nature of anxiety for me, has a lot of that in terms of a sort of just like vast statements and mantras and movies playing. So there's just a lot of things there. And I think something I've been thinking about a lot recently, which I guess is a similar idea, is just trying to go back to before those mantras come in and trying to slow down the time there. And say,
you mean back in your life, or just back in your mind, or back in your development, or back in your childhood?
Theoretically, I guess all those are possible. But I guess I'm thinking more mainly just in an instant, or in a thought pattern, or in a thought spiral, or what do you call it?
Yeah.
Anxiety spiral.
Yeah.
To like try to. I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying it's working, but like theoretically, it seems like it should work.
Tell me more about it. Yeah.
That you either catch at the beginning or you are all the way into the anxiety, but you can go back to the beginning. And I mean, I think ideally it would be instead of taking it on the, I guess, well-worn pathway of pre-established thought patterns, it would be more of a actually tuning into it and discovering and surmising and guessing and just taking, I mean, if one really did that every time, there'd be so many different places to go, and it would be, I don't know. I mean, it would be a very different journey of getting there. Even yes. if you got to the same spot.
Yes.
It would be like the whole process of getting there would be really different.
So it sounds like you're calling anxiety or the thought sequences that feed anxiety or trail along anxiety. You're kind of calling, I mean, those are, they're kind of a story or they're a sequence, yeah. they're a sequence, right?
Yeah.
And you're saying you can go back sort of to the beginning of that sequence and say, why did that sequence occur? Mm-hmm. Can I segment out that sequence and look at each step mm-hmm. and break it down and separate myself from it and realize that it was a coil unwinding
mm-hmm. yeah.
without any consent by me
mm-hmm.
right
mm-hmm.
and yet it unwound it was a coil winding mm-hmm. it took me with it. Without me ever saying I wanted to go,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, yeah, and without me, I guess, realizing it was happening or
yes.
saying I wanted to go there this time. Yeah.
yeah.
And I guess that probably happens because of, I mean, I would say the stories we hear and just the way we've trained, the way I've trained my thoughts, so just habit or the train, yeah, I guess the training or the habit or the upbringing.
Yeah.
Just takes it immediately down that slide, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, everybody's going to say things about how like most of our thoughts are not even thoughts, you know, they're just.
Or ours.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. They're not what we think of as thinking, like as if we're making decisions all in a row. They're actually just big patterns that sit right down on our head and eat us with mm-hmm. their ass.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like they take us over
mm-hmm.
and they're under us and they're in us and they're around us and they're running us all the time. And in a way, that's what I mean by story.
Yeah, right.
Is saying, what are those patterns? How are those things unfolding? How are those coils winding me up? How are those coils unwinding in me? And where are they taking me? And did I ever ask to go there? And how can I go back to where I was before they took me?
Mm-hmm.
That to me is about bang and finding the truth of bang.
Mm-hmm.
Because yeah. bang is, I would say, kind of, it's hard. Again, I think we're going to constantly be trying to define it, but I think it's bang is what there is before all that stuff is.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
And the truth of bang is incessantly, microtesimally, insanely eradicated by beings being explained by other beings,
mm-hmm.
by the incessant storiness of everything we say and the menagerie of beings that we throw out there and say, look, this is the world.
Mm-hmm.
And like, for instance, how my friend got to the point where he would say in public that authoritarianism is gaining a foothold across the Western world. There must have been all these things he read, all these things he mm-hmm. thought, things people said, all these assumptions he made, all these fears he embraced. And then he just gets to that. And it's like, go back.
Mm-hmm.
Before you get to that point where you embrace the anxiety and you embrace the fear and you embrace the fantasy and you embrace the lie, because
mm-hmm.
it's a lie. That's just a lie, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's so murky, right? Like what all this means and how to do it. It's just murky. Like I hear you explained it so well, like just trying to get back to the beginning and the first thing that happened before anxiety rolled its carpet all over your face.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And
or I guess then maybe it'd be better to say trying to get back to the other beginnings. You can't get back to the first beginning, so maybe there's that too.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting for you, right? Like instead
yeah.
of saying, how do I get back to what was there before like the seed of the anxiety, or as if there was an innocent, yeah, non-anxious state before the anxiety. What about just a whole different beginning, a whole different, because it's true, you are being run around in all these different ways, and the things are and it maybe disposition and mood have something to do with it. Maybe anxiety is the result of the disposition of wonder. And peace is a result of the disposition of guessing and inkling and imagining. I don't know.
Yeah, well, and I think also just that, and in a way, maybe that's why Heidegger doesn't try to rewrite the first beginning.
Right.
Because he recognizes that we're so formed, it's so there already. So that's why we're trying to get instead to the other beginning. I guess in a way it's to recognize the first beginning for what it is and to, I don't know if it's a restart, but to approach anew with the other beginning. And then I was just thinking that it's funny because then also the last, or then the other main phrase that has one of these words in it is like the last God. So there's a real timeline, or we're first, other, last. Like the first beginning versus the last God is interesting. But,
Yeah, say more. What?
Yeah. I think I already said it. But just, I think I said it.
I heard a little thing the other day. As this guy said, his little famous little Chinese proverb, as we called it. I mean, whatever, you know. He said, my favorite Chinese proverb. He said, the man who blames others has a long way to go. The man who blames himself is halfway there. The man who blames no one has already arrived.
What does that mean? Or what word do you?
I don't know.
Well, maybe we should end on that note.
Yeah, I think so. The man who blames others has a long way to go. The man who blames himself is halfway there. And the man who blames no one has already arrived.
That's nice.
All right.
Fun. Cool.
Yeah. To exhaustion.
Yeah.
Good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Cholla podcast. For more information, visit leapingcholla.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.